Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for October's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome to Webinar Club our speaker for today, lecturer at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies based at the University of Edinburgh, Emma Keeble. Thank you, Emma. Emma, I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me to speak today. Thank you also to those of you who've joined us. I know it's a busy time of year, and it's good. One-hour session that we will be talking about wildlife first aid and emergency care. Please do feel free to ask questions as we go along, and also at the end I'll make sure that there's a little bit of time so that we can answer any questions that may crop up as we go along. So this is a topic that's very dear to my heart. We are just in the process, hopefully, of producing the newest edition of the BSAVA Wildlife Manual of wildlife casualties, and something that I have a great passion for and have been involved for as well over the years. I worked for a period of time at a wildlife hospital, and we have a wildlife emergency clinic based at the vet school that's run mainly for students who can get hands-on experience dealing with wildlife cases, and the whole sort of ethos that goes with that, and the decision-making process. And this is something that I really wanted to sort of discuss with you today, how we sort of make those decisions about wildlife cases and whether we are going to treat or whether we may unfortunately have to euthanize. And I think that's absolutely key to the whole subject of wildlife first aid and care. So we'll hopefully come on to that in a little bit. And certainly, you know, it's never clear cut. There's always going to be grey areas where there will be discussion and debate. And this is something that actually makes it very interesting, and views you will find will vary greatly. So what are we hoping to achieve when we are bringing a wild casualty into our veterinary practice? What we need to understand is that this should be a temporary arrangement, that we have a duty of care to look after these animals and provide first aid where necessary, but that the ultimate aim has got to be to release these animals back to the wild, as they are wild animals, and that is the whole purpose. What I think we probably don't realise is how many centres there are around the UK dealing with wildlife casualties, and these can vary from sort of large hospital setups to smaller sort of individual people who are looking after wild casualties. And so there's quite a variable level of skill and of care that's involved with wild animals. Also, the other thing I think we need to understand is that a large number do not make it, and this is not necessarily a bad thing. It's a positive welfare decision to euthanize a wild animal if it's suffering. Some of the figures that are available, as I've quoted in that slide there, are that only 50% of animals that come into captivity are subsequently successfully released, and I do think this is something we need to bear in mind. It's not necessarily, you know, these animals have being given a second chance by being picked up, and they probably would not necessarily have survived in the wild because of their injuries. I also thought it would be quite interesting to look at what are the most common species, because these are going to be relevant to people in veterinary practice. What are we most likely to see being brought in? And top of my list certainly are hedgehogs, and there have been quite a few studies that have looked at most common species that are admitted to wildlife hospitals in the UK. And we also had a little look ourselves at our own wildlife emergency clinic and came up with very similar numbers and species. So hedgehogs are really at top of the list, and then, you know, pigeons and smaller birds such as blackbirds, particularly at certain times of year. And wildlife rehabilitation is very sort of seasonal. You do see these differences at different times when these animals are more likely to come in. The other thing that we do see as well is geographical differences. Depending on where you are, you might see more badger species, some people may see more otter species. Certainly when I worked in the southwest, we did see a lot of otters. And so it's going to be very variable depending on where you are within the UK. The other thing I think we need to be aware of is that a large number, so I've got almost half of the admissions, are actually young animals. Now, in the past, we've kind of tentatively called these orphans, but a lot of these animals are not necessarily orphaned. They perhaps have got into a situation where a member of the public has seen them and picked them up, but the parents may still be local and around. So if we can reduce those admissions by educating the public, then that will make a massive difference as well. But looking at those young animals, the most common causes for coming in are traumatic injury, in particular cat attacks, because they're very vulnerable, and a lot of these are young fledgling birds that are just at that time of leaving the nest but not able to fly fully, and these are very, very vulnerable obviously to cat attack. So you could ask, why bother with wildlife? I mean, really, it's you know, one of those things that I get asked a lot, particularly certainly some vets really do believe, is it worth going through all this process? Now, you know, one thing that Pat Morris sort of brought to the fore was whether this was actually about more making us feel better and the feel-good factor associated with it. I mean, it's quite amazing to get hands-on experience with wild animals. And also if they are then released, you know, you feel really good about it. But are we really doing the right thing by that animal, and is it in the best interests of that animal? And that's where I was talking about the sort of grey area and sort of really all the ethics around wildlife rehabilitation. In my mind, there are several reasons why I think we should bother. Some of these are sort of the larger picture. Some of these are perhaps about individual welfare. But certainly using techniques to go forward and be able to then use the same techniques on rarer species is one potential reason why we should bother. And that sort of comes in under the information bracket. I think certainly where you've got key endangered species, conservation is absolutely important. And this may not be quite as relevant within the UK, although we do have some fairly rare species, particularly of amphibians. But in other countries, again, you know, conserving a species that potentially is threatened in the wild is quite important. We need to think about the individual animal's welfare as well as the welfare of the species. And I guess, you know, it is important that we make sure, you know, we get a good amount of public support and that we educate the public. But also to be seen to be rehabilitating wild animals is very much an emotive thing for members of the public, and they get very involved. And particularly if they brought a case into you, it's very common for people to phone up and want to know what's happened. So this is somewhere where we as vets can be sort of educational in that way, and sort of talk about the welfare of the individual and whether it's the right thing to proceed with any first aid or rehabilitation. So when we're trying to make this decision as to what we do with an animal that's brought into us, I do think welfare has to be paramount, and we have to keep our main goals in mind. You know, the ultimate goal is for release. If we aren't able to do that, then the two other options would be euthanasia, particularly if the wound is going to be, or the condition is going to be painful and cause suffering. But there is, I guess, another option, permanent captivity, and some rehabilitators will very much advocate this, that it's life no matter what. Now, this is something that we as individual veterinary surgeons have to decide where we stand in terms of our own personal views, and open up a dialogue with local rehabilitators and come to an agreement with them. Because certainly if we opt for permanent captivity, we have to, I feel, ensure that the five freedoms are met for that individual animal. And if they're not being able to be met, then I think welfare may be compromised. So that's my stance on it. But, you know, it's an area for debate that you know, is of interest to everybody. But I do think dialogue is absolutely key. I think another thing that we need to think about is it actually possible to treat the animal? And within that, is treatment possible? We need to really think about that individual animal's behavior, whether it's migratory, whether it comes from a social group and we'll miss that, what age it is and what time of year could be relevant in terms of whether it's safe to release it back to the wild. So there's a whole set of questions that we need to be asking about each individual that comes in to try and determine whether we can make that decision to keep it in captivity. And I guess it depends on how long the injury is likely to take to heal, whether, as we said, it's physically possible to get it back to sort of 100% fitness. And also there are some species that will get very stressed with being in captivity, and we need to bear that in mind as well. So things like oil birds, there's been a big debate over whether it's right to treat oil birds. It's a very emotive area, subject area, because obviously public are very much aware if there's been an oil spill and want to get involved and want to help. What I think we do need to do is perhaps improve our techniques so that our post-release survival rates are higher. And this is a problem, obviously, because of the side effects of oil intoxication. Where we've got injuries that are perhaps man-induced, and this is about a couple of pictures of badger with snare injuries, then maybe we could argue we have a duty of care to correct those man-involved situations and to do something to help the welfare of this animal. Now, in both these cases, the injuries were far too severe to consider rehabilitation, but there is a large sort of body of thought that we should intervene in cases where there are human associated problems occurring in wildlife species. Another thing that we often get asked or need to think about is, you know, who's actually going to pay for all this treatment? What is interesting is obviously we do have a duty of care to treat any wild animal casualties during normal practice hours. And this is something, you know, that we as veterinary surgeons have to do. However, for larger animals and out of hours, then there is a memorandum of understanding that has been written up between the BVA and the RSPCA, and that this, you know, there will be some compensation for veterinary surgeons who are attending perhaps the scene of an accident involving a wildlife casualty or out of hours. So this is something that again needs to be sort of discussed and talked about if you're brought in an animal via an RSPCA inspector. I also thought I'd put a little bit about legislation, because this comes into play when we're admitting wildlife casualties into the veterinary practice. Now, a lot of the species under the Wildlife and Countryside Act are protected. For veterinary surgeons, we are able to treat and look after injured wild animals for a longer period of time than members of the public without actually registering them. So it is an area we need to be aware of what the legislation is, and but generally for an animal that's coming in and sort of being stabilized for a 24-hour period, we shouldn't have to worry too much about it. But there is a whole plethora of legislation that's there to protect wild animals, and these are important to be considering when we're dealing with wild species. So, coming back to the wildlife casualty, we are presented with a wild animal at the practice. We need to be thinking, what are the key things and an assessment criteria for this animal, and really a rapid assessment is, I feel, key. It's quite common for these animals to be put in a box and perhaps left somewhere, and maybe veterinary nurses are perhaps asked to have a look at them. If we can get in and make a very quick, rapid assessment, then we can make sure that that animal is not suffering for any longer than it needs to be, particularly if it's a really nasty injury. And when we're making these decisions, as I said earlier, we do need to think about the animal's welfare, the legislation involved, and something I haven't really touched upon but also is very key is health and safety. We'll talk a little bit about this later. So what we're going to do with this animal is we're going to triage it, and I thought it would be interesting to sort of consider where does the word come from. We use it a lot in veterinary practice, but it's actually from the French word trier, which means to sort of select or sort through, and it basically means prioritizing animals to determine the ones that are most likely to survive. Now, this is something that would be key if you had a mass incident, but also, obviously, we need to triage the individual animal as well. So Yes, as I mentioned, much more relevant to mass incidents such as oilings or cetacean strandings. But we also need to essentially do the same process with each individual animal that we're presented with. So when looking at triage, you can actually divide it into six main stages, and at each way along these six stages, we need to be thinking, is this the right decision for that animal, and should we proceed with our care and with our treatment? So it's not something that you kind of make a snap decision on and say, right, we're going to treat this animal and it's going to be okay. We need to be reassessing it regularly at each of these stages to see whether this is the right decision and the right opportunity for that animal. So we'll be covering all these different stages as we work through the presentation. As I've mentioned earlier, obviously the main aim is to return the animal to the wild and ideally release it such that it's got an equal chance of survival as its other free living members of the species. So, you know, an animal that's not 100% fit to survive really should not be released. And then you have the decision whether you can provide for it in captivity or whether it should be euthanized. The other thing we really need to take into account is, you know, we release an animal and we think that's success, but actually we don't always know what happens to that animal once it's been released. And really a measure of success would be post-release survival rates. And this is something where we as veterinary surgeons can potentially work with rehabilitators to try and improve our assessment of animals and how they cope with being released and how long they survive following that, and compare it perhaps to survival rates in the wild. But these are sort of areas for research and further work. I quite like this little decision-making tree. I think it's very clear and easy to follow. As you can see, and I sort of mentioned this earlier, each step of the way through the decision-making tree, we have got the option of euthanasia just to be reassessing whether this is the right decision for that particular animal. As I mentioned, euthanasia should not be seen as a negative thing. It is a positive welfare decision, given all the information, given all the facts, given the evaluation and clinical assessment of that animal, and it is alleviating suffering. So a lot of these cases that come in as wildlife cases, they're basically picked up because they are severely injured and they're not coping in the wild. And so ending that sort of suffering and pain and you know, making sure that is actually a positive thing, and explaining, I think this is quite important to the public when who've bought the animal in, that this is actually in some ways a positive thing for that animal, because obviously it can be very upsetting if people have got very attached to the animal and then you make the decision to euthanize it. So see that as an educational opportunity, and if people are phoning back in to inquire about wildlife that they've handed in, you know, again, maybe have your receptionists have a small set piece that they will say to the owners, to the members of public, and I think that's really, really important, because this is somewhere where people can get very upset and emotive. Talking about methods of euthanasia in birds, I prefer the intravenous route. So in little birds, we might do a quick gas down with induction with a gaseous anesthetic and then an IV. In larger birds like swans, you can get a really nice easy IV access using the medial tarsal vein. And you can see that in the top picture there, we place an IV catheter. If you had to in a sort of quick and emergency situation, then intrahepatic administration of barbiturates is actually relatively straightforward, although if you miss and go into an air sac, that potentially could be quite painful. The intrahepatic route in birds is literally just at the, you feel the ventral edge of the sternum and you go in at a 45 degree angle, and that should hit the liver and be an instant demise for that animal. With larger mammals, we do require sedation or anesthesia, so these could be administered intramuscularly, perhaps in a crush cage, or if you've got, you know, heavy blankets that you can immobilize the animal and then anesthetize it, and then you can find an intravenous access. In smaller mammals, again, using it maybe gaseous induction and then intravenous or intracardiac to actually euthanize. So once these animals are coming into us, we need to think about how we handle them. We need to think about the stress these animals are wild. They're not used to being handled. When I first started doing a lot of postmortems on wild animal species, I was amazed at the size of the animals' adrenal glands, and they're so much bigger than pet animals. And I think this is something that, you know, is related to their survival in the wild and the stresses that they are under. So think about subdued lighting, reducing noise levels, covering the animal so that they feel more secure, and also minimizing the time that you're actually examining them for. We also need to be aware, particularly for ourselves and our staff, of the dangers that might be involved. These could be physical dangers, such as, you know, beaks, talons, wings in birds, or teeth and antlers. And I would add also hooves from deer to the mammal section. But there could also be zoonotic potential as well, and we'll come on to that in just a second. Dangers. It's very important really to have standard operating procedures in place for staff so they know how to handle animals safely. There should be training as well. And we have these for the more dangerous animals that might come in, particularly the larger mammals. And it is really, really important to be aware of any potential dangers to yourself and to staff, and also if you've got people you're training as well. I put a picture to the top. One you'll notice is actually an African pygmy hedgehog, but the European hedgehog's at the bottom. You can see, I love this picture on the right, but as you can see, this person's not actually wearing gloves, and this is absolutely key with hedgehogs. We're going to talk about zoonosis in a minute, but certainly dermatophytosis ringworm is a real problem in wild hedgehogs and something that you and your staff could contract, so we always recommend wearing gloves in this species. So as I said, I mentioned zoonoses. There are a large number. I've listed just a few there on this slide. We're all very much aware, I think, of hedgehogs, as I mentioned. You can see the picture at the top. This animal's looking quite scurfy. There's spine lost. Sometimes you get crusting around the skirt area. And I would be very cautious with that animal because I'd be worried that it is actually a ringworm carrier. We also hopefully are all very much aware of handling of bats, in particular Dorbenton species, and the possibility of rabies, and we need to have standard operating procedures in place for our staff if there's the likelihood of you dealing with bats. We also should have rabies vaccinations, and bats should always be handled with gloves. So that's an area that we have to be very much aware of. And people who are dealing also with badgers on a regular basis, being aware of the risks of TB to staff. So if we've got open wounds, if we've got discharges, we really need to be thinking about the risk to staff and wearing appropriate protective clothing and appropriate sort of quarantine type procedures in place. So coming back to the actual wildlife casualty, most that are coming into us are likely to be emergencies. And this is where I do sometimes get a little bit upset that these animals are not looked at straight away. If an animal comes in, if you can have a sort of protocol where there is a key person who can be asked to have a quick look at this animal, assess whether it needs euthanasia, get a little bit of a history, and then, you know, make that initial triage decision, that will alleviate a lot of suffering. We do also get signed consent from whoever brings the animal in, and we get information about where the animal was obtained and the sort of situation it was found in, and we get contact details. So that is really important if it's brought in by a member of the public. So once we've made that initial sort of assessment, decided whether it's going to stay in captivity or whether it's going to be put down, we need to think about some quick initial therapy, thinking about giving fluids, particularly warmth as well. A lot of wild animals are hypothermic and perhaps hypovolemic, and so providing a gradual warming using incubators or whatever heating sources you have available is really key. We need to think about any treatments that are going to be provided, particularly analgesia, and if we've got any wounds or hemorrhage or fractures, we need to administer first aid to sort these out. This can be very quick initial therapy, and then we leave the animal quiet. There's going to be a lot of stress it's been under with transport and with your initial quick assessment. We give it a period of rest where that animal can recuperate for half an hour or so just to reduce the stress. I just want to put this picture in. It's a very old picture, but you can see there's purulent material coming from the nose of this badger. We've got severe bite wounds around the neck. It was absolutely emaciated, and the decision was immediately made to euthanize. This is also likely to be a high sort of zoonotic risk, but also that individual was suffering over a long period because of the weight loss and the general condition of this animal. When we looked actually also in the mouth, its teeth were very worn, so it's likely to be a very aged animal that's been picked on. This is a hedgehog that had a laceration to the head associated with a garden strimmer, and that's quite a common injury in hedgehogs. Unfortunately, they tend to hide in long grass, and when people use strimmers, they can be quite severely injured. You can actually see part of the skull exposed in that picture, and the decision again was made fairly quickly to euthanize this animal. You'll notice it's been anesthetized. That made it easier for us to examine properly because it kept curling up and you couldn't actually see that part of the animal. So hedgehogs, sometimes you might need to anesthetize them fairly quickly, even perhaps before them being properly stabilized to assess them. Once they've kind of had this short period of rest, this initial assessment, then I think we really do need to go back and do a more thorough examination. And this is something that can be a little bit later down the line when you're perhaps less busy with clinics and you've got a spare 10 minutes. It is important to consider your method of examination. It should really be as for other animals, and cranial to caudal I find easiest. That's just the way we teach, but whichever method you use, it's very, very easy to miss things in wildlife because they're hiding signs of illness. So monitoring from a distance can be really helpful. And we've got this little bird at the top there. You can see it's fully weight bearing on both feet. Its wings aren't dropped. It looks quite bright, but there aren't many droppings around, and that could be a sign that it's actually quite, it isn't well nourished, it hasn't actually eaten recently. The bottom picture shows a crossbow that had been fired at a swan. Again, this was a horrific injury that this animal came in with, but doing proper assessment of it prior to making a decision whether we can treat or not was key. So just again, thinking about our examination, it's really important not to miss any areas. Start perhaps from the head. Things we need to do is get vital parameters. So we need to get the weight, ideally respiratory rate, heart rate if we can, temperature. And I would assess body condition as well. So not just get a weight, actually have a feel hands-on whether that animal is thin or not. If it's a big animal, male swan, for instance, it might weigh quite a lot, but actually its body condition could be poor. Then we start from head end back down and make sure that we check everything really well. One thing I would say is always look in the eyes because we might have ocular hemorrhage if there's been trauma, particularly in birds of prey. This is quite common and we need to be ensuring that these animals can see properly so that they can function well in the wild. It is also very easy to miss, particularly in birds, fractures of the wings or limbs, particularly small birds. It can be very difficult to see. So looking at sort of wing position, how the animal's holding the wing, is absolutely key to assess whether there's a problem. And sometimes it might be necessary to sort of almost observe from a distance or to creep up on the animal and have a look when it doesn't know it's being observed so that you can assess this more fully. So, again, we need to be thinking once we've done the full assessment, is this a case that I can take forward? Is euthanasia the kindest option or are we going to treat? Things that carry a sort of poor prognosis, if the animal's very emaciated, we need to be thinking about why is that, what's been going on with this individual, and that, you know, is not a good thing for an animal if they are really underweight. If we've got high levels of ectoparasites, again, it's a sign that this animal hasn't been coping well in the wild. And certainly if we've got wing or limb fractures, then that is another area that we seriously need to consider, because it's going to take quite a long time for that animal to get back to fitness. And perhaps you could argue with a fracture, it's never going to be 100% the same as the good leg. We need to ensure that our repair is really, really good. So then we come on to think about first aid. And this is perhaps, you know, key to the title of this lecture, but also I think key to then progressing with cases. Very similar really to think about all the things that we would in domestic species, but we do need to take into account the stress to that animal, the fact it's a wild animal, and how it's actually going to cope with sort of standard procedures such as fluid therapy. We also need to make sure if there is any hemorrhage that we stop that immediately. We could perhaps, you know, put a dressing on as a short-term thing and apply pressure. So things like that can be done very quickly. And then more long-term, if it's staying in sort of overnight or 24 hours before it can go to a rehabilitation place, then we need to be thinking about what we're going to feed it, what water, what provision for accommodation we're going to give as well. So thinking about fluid therapy, the principles are very similar in wildlife as to domestic species, but whether we can actually apply them and administer the fluids is another matter. What we're aiming to do, obviously, is correct any dehydration, electrolyte imbalances, and hypovolemia, but we need to be thinking, when we're looking at the species in front of us, how easy is that going to be to administer the fluid and maintain any potential intravenous or intraosseous lines? How are we going to monitor it, and how are we going to ensure that the line remains patent for a period of time? So it might be that you don't want to actually set up a drip line and bag. You might want to administer boluses of fluids so the animal can still move around, but you have to then take into account whether the animal is dangerous or not, because you need to be going in regularly with that individual to administer the fluids. So all of these factors need to come into play when we're deciding whether we give fluid therapy. So we need to think, is the fluid therapy needed? How are we going to give it? What type are we going to give, and for how long and at what rate? And more longer term, how are we going to determine that we've been successful in our fluid therapy, and how are we going to monitor for any side effects? So assessing hydration status obviously is key to determine whether we actually need to give the fluid. And then we need to think about what fluid type we're going to give, what sort of losses have occurred. You can see in the picture here we've got a small seal pup that was very dehydrated, and it's actually being given intravenous fluids. Now, once this animal's brighter, it's going to be able to move around more, and probably that IV line will come out. It's just held in place in situ with an IV, with a needle. So we've got this careful balance, really. In birds, we want to be thinking about assessing the hydration status, you know, what percentage of dehydration has that individual got, and then tailoring our fluid volumes accordingly. And it's quite a useful rule of thumb that we can give really quite high fluid volumes in shock. So a rapid bolus of 10 mils per kilo can be administered if we need to. But when we come back down to maintenance, 50 mils per kilogram per day, 50 to 100 mils really per kilogram per day is quite a good sort of benchmark to work from. We've got a variety of routes that we can use. Now, obviously, if we can get intravenous interosseous routes, we're going to be able to boost that blood volume a lot quicker. But there are some situations where giving warmed subcutaneous fluids and warming the animal as well, you can get relatively quick absorption. And I've put a little bit on the bottom of that slide about the potential for using hyaluronidase to perhaps increase absorption of subcutaneous fluids in wild animals. Birds do tolerate tube feeding very well. You can see at the top of the picture an animal being tube fed. If they're very debilitated, though, the GI transit time may be slowed down. You may have a crop stasis. The bird may regurgitate, and there is the risk of inhalation. If we've got a very debilitated animal, I think really the intravenous and intraosseous routes are perhaps more relevant. One thing we sometimes forget is with the young birds, and as I mentioned right at the start, the high percentage of animals that come into you may be young birds. Their instant reaction once they're feeling better, once they're warmed up, is actually to gape. So this is a way that you could easily administer fluids without really needing to be too interventional with that animal. So just dipping a paintbrush in a little bit of warmed electrolyte solution and attempting to brush that against the side of the beak will actually elicit a gape reflex, and this animal can then receive fluids via that route. I mentioned gavaging in birds, and we use these sort of metal crop tubes that are available commercially for parrot species. So this is a macaw size that we're using in a juvenile seagull. But you can use plastic tubing, you can use lamb feeding tubes and perhaps drip tubing, as long as the end is soft and has been sort of molded in a Bunsen flame so that it's melted and soft, then you can use these easily. One thing you do have to be careful of, obviously, is not losing the tube or the animal biting through the tube. So here's a bird of prey being administered more critical care, nutritional supportive diet. And it's relatively straightforward. It does require two people, obviously, to do that process. When it comes to mammals, again, we need to be assessing what the hydration status of that animal is. There's certain key things we can use, fairly similar really to domestic animals. We can do skin tenting. In seals, we can look at the tear film around the eye, and they should have quite wet eyes. And if that is dry, if they've not actually got proper sort of tear ducts, so the tears just run onto the fur, you should have normal sort of wet patches in a well-hydrated animal. But if that's not occurring, then you would be concerned that that animal is dehydrated. Again, we've got quite high shock volumes that we can administer fairly rapidly, and then we need to think about, with levels of dehydration, how quickly we hydrate that animal. Our maintenance requirements, a little bit higher perhaps than in birds, and again, we need to look at fluid type and routes for administration. So if you've got a very debilitated animal, such as this fox in the picture here, then we might be able to get IV access and place an IV catheter. Quite often with foxes and badgers and deer, this may be done initially under sedation, and then that IV catheter is left in situ. But those animals can very quickly recover and get to the point where that needs removing. And that poses a situation where you're then going to have to go in with the animal and handle it, and you have a risk to staff. So if you're not used to handling these sorts of larger wild mammals on a regular basis, it might be better to administer boluses in this case. And if need be, perhaps go for more the subcutaneous route so you don't have to go in with the animal if it suddenly revives. Again, with small mammals, these are pictures of small juvenile animals that have been brought in that are actually being given milk feeds, but the suck reflex is really quite strong, even when they're very tiny. So using this to administer fluids can be very helpful. Once they are warmed, though, you really need to make sure the animal, if it's hypothermic, is actually warmed to a thermoneutral range. And once the suck reflex is evident, then to try fluids via this route. I certainly wouldn't be starting to syringe fluids in if they're not actually sucking, because you could then have a high risk of aspiration. But another, interesting point that we can sometimes be more hands-off and actually get fluids into an animal via a fairly normal route. Once we've considered our fluid losses and we've corrected for any fluid imbalances, then we need to think about the more long-term nutritional requirements of that individual animal. And certainly a lot of the smaller species of birds and mammals that come to us do have very high metabolic rates, and we fairly quickly need to provide energy, perhaps in the form of glucose or perhaps in the form of an appropriate diet. One thing that was quite interesting and kind of makes sense really is that larger animals can survive longer without food. So small birds need to eat very regularly to maintain their normal nutrition. What we should do as well is think about providing a diet that's kind of as near to the wild diet as possible, so that the animal actually accepts it and recognizes it as food, and it's also then less likely to cause any gastrointestinal upsets. There are a lot of commercially available diets now, which are really super actually, and can be used. If you need to in the sort of short term, you can use veterinary clinical recovery diets that are commercially available. But there are also a really good range of exotic pet recovery diets. One in particular, we sort of use a company called Lefebvre, and they produce critical care diets that are herbivore, omnivore, carnivore, and they do actually have a piscivore diet as well. But there are many different types available. And again, thinking about how we're going to administer these, why not just try initially in a bowl and see if the animal will eat? You know, see the little hedgehog there has poked his nose out and is about to tuck into a lovely bowl full of cat food. You know, try that initially. It's least stress, but you can also consider crop tubing in birds if you're really worried that they need a feed immediately. And some mammals, particular things like badgers that are perhaps sort of semi-comatose, will sometimes lap a liquid-based diet from a syringe. Now, obviously, again, I wouldn't recommend this unless you're very used to handling badgers, but that can be a sort of non-stressful way of administering fluids fairly quickly. Thinking about fractures, again, general rules of fracture management do apply to wildlife casualties. One thing I would really urge as a take-home message is, you know, assess it very accurately first, find out where the fracture is. Birds in particular, because of their shoulder anatomy, it can be really difficult to diagnose a coracoid or clavicle fracture. So, you know, proper assessment of the bird is key. And we need to be thinking about where the fracture is, whether it's close to a joint. That's obviously going to be more difficult to sort, whether it involves a growth plate in a young animal, if we've got any infection there, and also the chronicity. And we sometimes see in wildlife horrific fractures that are very old, you know, the end of the bone and already necrotic. There's a massive amount of infection present. In those sorts of cases, we need to just be thinking really about the welfare of the animal and whether euthanasia is actually better in those cases. Making the decision as to whether this is a suitable animal for or a suitable fracture for repair is quite a difficult process and really needs to be carefully gone through, perhaps also with other colleagues as well, because you've really got to think about what's going to happen to that animal. You might be able to fix it, but what's then going to happen to that animal in the wild and also in the rehabilitation process? They're going to be in captivity for a long period of time to be able to build up muscles around the fracture site so they can support it and be fully weight-bearing or flying. And is that bird or animal then going to be able to cope and actually fend for itself in the wild? One of the things I often talk about are gannets that, you know, they dive and they hit the ocean at great speeds. You know, we might be able to mend a humeral fracture in a gannet, but will it be able to actually fish, be able to achieve those speeds and be able to fold its wings appropriately to enable that dive? So you really do have to think about the animal and how it feeds, how it copes in the wild situation. Things that we can do either short term to stabilize a fracture or, you know, obviously more longer term if we're going to actually heal a fracture. In birds, we can use the figure of eight wing bandages, which I'll come on to show you in just a minute. Ball bandages for the feet work very well. You can see one in the picture here. And also we can use little Altman splints in small birds, and these are literally just sort of tape splints that you can use on the lower limbs, sometimes with cotton bud supports or wooden, you know, supports either side. And we can use Robert Jones bandages as well in birds. In mammals, we might want to splint a fracture, and we might want to think about perhaps external or internal fixation. So this is a cadaver that I had that I wanted to just show you, the figure of eight bandage, which is a really useful one, really for fractures below the carpus, but also for radius and ulnar fractures. And you can also use it for humeral fractures if you modify it and put it actually around the whole body of the bird. So you usually start at the carpus, and I like to start on top of the carpus and fold the bandage underneath, as you can see in the picture. And it then comes back round in a sort of figure at the start of the top of your eight, if you like, so that you've got that nicely secured and anchored. And then the bottom of the bandage has gone back under the wing and come round again to form the final part of the figure of eight. The way I've done this, this would secure a carpal fracture or a radial ulnar fracture. Really, for a humeral fracture, we would then need to take this bandage around the body of the bird, taking two straps around, one each side of the wing on the opposite side, and that would secure it nicely so that the humerus is also immobilized. With soft tissue injuries in wildlife, again, general principles apply, and really you can use your knowledge in domestic species to treat these injuries. Again, just looking at the stress to the animal and the chronicity of how long it's likely to take us to get these lesions healed. Dressings may be applied, but again, you've got to think about how these are going to be taken off, whether that will require an anesthetic, or whether it's something you can safely do by just handling the animal conscious, and also need to then think how stressful is that going to be for that animal. We do tend to see quite a few distal limb injuries in deer. You can see the bottom picture there when they've been caught in fencing, and these are pretty nasty injuries that can quite often cut down to ligaments and bone, and a lot of these injuries, the animal is not going to be able to cope with in the wild, particularly if you've got ligament damage. So a lot of these are euthanized, unfortunately. This was a badger fight wound that was particularly severe, and we actually did a skin flap on this, and it worked fairly well. But we do tend to see these lesions quite commonly in badgers that have been fighting. And some of them can be very, very large. They do tend to do fairly well and don't tend to take that long to heal. I would say probably I wouldn't clip again as much as hair as this, because obviously that's leaving that area really exposed when the animal gets released. You need to make sure that it's fully hair covered, because that provides some protection against further bites. And you need to be thinking about why the animal came in with this injury in the first place as well. Here are some horrible lesions that we see in hedgehogs. Quite often strimmer injuries can end up removing a limb. You then have the decision, should we euthanize this animal, or is this animal going to go into long-term captivity? And again, as I said earlier, this is an area for debate and you know, discussion with your local rehabilitator. The top picture just shows an abscess of the foot. Again, very common in hedgehogs, and they seem to get very diseased very easily, hedgehogs, and come in with most horrific injuries. This is a line injury in a cygnet. You might look at this injury, it's on the ventral aspect of the mandible, and think that this is actually a laceration, but when you dig deep, you can actually feel this sort of chin strap, they call it, and you can see on in the lower picture that we've managed to identify the end of the fishing line, and we've got artery forceps on that so that we don't lose it, and this will gently peel back and round and be removed from the mandible. And I have seen that so severe that the actual lower mandible had been cheese wired through and was falling off. Obviously that case was not suitable for rehabilitation. Something else we need to think about why animals would come in, possibly poisoning. It's quite common in wild animal species because they can pick up poisons that have been put down for vermin control, or potentially slug pellets and things like that that have been used for gardening. So if we've got information about the history or the likelihood of any intoxication, that can be very helpful so we can target any particular antidotes or treatment. But a lot of the time these cases are just supportive, and the pitch you see here is actually of lead toxicity in a cygnet, and we're trying to flush particles of lead from its ventriculus, its gizzard, and remove those orally. The animal is actually anaesthetized. This is also just to touch on lead toxicity in swans, which hopefully is now less of a concern, although still, you know, prevalent, because obviously fishing weights now are not lead-based, but you can still see cases, there's still a degree of lead around, and certainly if there's been a period of bad weather where things have got washed through or there's been increased rain, then, you know, lead can be washed through into rivers and then picked up by swans. You can see fishing hooks as well. It's a common presentation. The swan in the swan bag is just showing a classic sort of swan neck associated with weakness, which can be a sign of lead toxicity. Another thing we commonly encounter animals being brought in with for emergency care would be any shotgun-associated wounds. These often are found radiographically. You can see from the picture here, we can see some pellets, but we need to determine whether these are clinically significant or not. Often they do become walled off, and an animal may live with them without any apparent discomfort. What can happen, though, if they're very fresh, is that as it tracks through the soft tissue, it will take in with it feathers or hair and debris, and they can be very contaminated, and so they might require veterinary attention and possibly surgery to remove that debris. I also wanted to touch on the fact that, you know, sometimes we have to anaesthetize animals. It kind of goes against the grain if we've got an emergency animal coming in, but to actually get hands-on and handle and treat and diagnose, then often anaesthesia may come into it. So obviously we can get hands-on with a little tiny duckling, but with larger mammals such as this badger, we might have to consider for operator safety as well, that we sedate it first so we can do a proper clinical exam. And at the same time, we can give any treatments and we could administer fluids to. So that animal would have received an intramuscular injection to sedate it. Just a few points with anaesthesia in diving seabirds and seals. We need to be thinking about the dive reflex. So the heart rate will slow and the respiratory rate will slow, and try and avoid this. We might want to think about crush cages or using remote injection so that we don't have to get too hands-on with any more dangerous or larger mammals. Fasting is often not an option in wild animals, although a lot of the cases that are coming in may not have eaten anyhow because of their debilitating problem. But certainly seabirds and birds of prey, we might want to fast because they can regurgitate. And then we need to be thinking about the usual sort of monitoring techniques and provision of heat and how we're going to actually induce anaesthesia and what type we're going to use. Another massive area we need to think about is pain relief, and this is really key to good success rates in wild animals. They can hide signs, and so we want to ensure that they are given analgesics even if they don't appear to be in obvious pain. If we've got lesions that would cause pain in other animals, we need to be providing good analgesia. And the same sort of classes of analgesic drugs apply to wildlife as they do domestic species, and we often extrapolate dose rates from domestic animals. So I've just put a few on that slide for you. Very similar really to other domestic animals in terms of the dose rates, and all of these hopefully are readily available in various different formularies for you, but they're ones that we would use fairly routinely. Thinking about therapeutics, we need to be thinking about how we get medications into these animals, and probably the easiest way is putting it in their food if they're going to actually eat the food, maybe providing a small amount of food first to ensure that medication is given. Reducing handling is going to reduce stress, so that is key as well. And as I mentioned, there are a lot of good exotics formularies available now that do have wild animal dose rates in them as well. And thinking also about how we're going to care for this animal, perhaps overnight or just for a day or two while it's in our care and before it can be picked up by a rehabilitator, we need to be thinking about, can we provide a good enough environment for it? And often veterinary practices aren't that good in that they're noisy environments and we don't have sort of separate quiet areas for wild animals. But the same rules really apply to a wildlife inpatient as it would a dog or cat inpatient. We do need to be keeping records, observing what they're doing, measuring their basic parameters, making sure they're warm enough. And, you know, all of that is really basic nursing techniques that we should have in place for all species. So this is the wildlife ward that we have at the vet school. We've got two walk-in kennels that we can keep seals or larger birds such as swans in. And we've got an area of smaller cages and incubators. We've got oxygen obviously available at all times as well. And this is a fox just showing you the sort of setup we've used there, a hide area with a box which it's managed to jump on and trash, but providing sort of areas to hide is really key. And then finally, just thinking about the last sort of final stages of this process, we need to think about rehabilitation. Probably not something we as vets may get that involved in with, but we do have a duty of care for that animal and making sure that we have appropriate facilities that we can hand the animal on to and getting good dialogue, good relationships formed with local rehabilitators. It's really, really key. And then our final goal, as I mentioned with the triage slide earlier on, is that we release this animal. And we need to be having chats with rehabilitators about how this is going to go on. Are we going to do a sort of hard release where the animal's just let loose to the wild? Or are we going to provide a soft release, which is where we're giving them supportive feeding for a period of time afterwards? And as I mentioned before, we really want to know how these animals do once they've been released. You know, there's no point going through this whole process if they don't survive, you know, any long-term rates. So really having post-release monitoring is key to sort of looking to the future. So that has been our, you know, fairly whirlwind sort of tour of wildlife triage and emergency care. I have just a couple of very quick questions that have come up as I've been going through, and please do feel free to put any further up if you need to. One thing that someone has asked is whether what sort of length of time we can bandage birds' wings for, and that's something I didn't really touch on. If we are doing wing bandages in birds, we need to be taking these off really every 2 to 3 days to move the joints and prevent any sort of contracture of muscles. So you can then replace it, no problem, but we need to be doing a little bit of physiotherapy every 2 to 3 days to ensure that that wing is able to move, the joints don't become anclosed, and you know, to do a little bit of free movement with the wing. So wing fractures heal very quickly in birds, really 2 to 3 weeks for bone healing. So this is something that we could practically do and continue to rebandage if need be. Another question that came through was assessment of hydration status in birds, which I didn't really touch on, but one way you can check in birds whether they are dehydrated is looking at the venous refill time and turgidity of the basilic vein. And this is situated on the underside of the wing at the point of the elbow. So you can have a look at that, press it, and if you get fairly quick refill, really less than 2 seconds, then they're relatively well hydrated. If you're getting greater than 1 to 2 seconds, you know, you're looking at between 5% and 7% dehydration, and that's quite a common way to assess hydration status in birds. So I want to thank you very much for listening to the webinar today. I hope you found it informative and useful, and thank you for joining me.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Emma for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.